Hello, in this audio clip, we'll continue talking about the United States Senate and looking into why it is such a terrible idea that needs to be removed from any future constitution. In the previous audio clip, we saw that there were two fundamental concerns or issues with the Senate. First, we saw that it was the product or the fruit of compromise. And many consider it part of what is called the Great Compromise of the 1787 Constitutional Convention, meaning that it was not forged out of someone building up to that idea through logical thinking and analyzing the best way to form a legislative branch. It was formed out of an effort to try to accommodate competing points of view. And as history has shown time and again, things that are born out of compromise tend to, in the long term, produce more problems than the benefits they are supposed to bring. So that's one issue we saw, that it was the product of compromise. And the second issue we saw is that it had an air of elitism surrounding it. The concept of the Senate is very elitist at its core. If you keep peeling the layers, the external layers, you keep finding elitism. So those were the two fundamental concerns or issues that we saw in the previous audio clip. And this time we will look into some of the problems that have stemmed or that can be seen in having a legislature that has a Senate sub-branch in it. And the first thing we'll talk about is the issue of the defense of minorities. And the reason for saying it like that is that usually when people defend the Senate, the concept of the Senate, they always emphasize, oh, the Senate is a place where the little states can be protected from the big states because the Senate has the same provides the same voting power to both small and large states. So that means that a very small state like Rhode Island has the same voting power as a big state like Texas or California or New York. And people say, hey, this allows a little tiny states to defend themselves or have a better chance of protecting themselves from the possible oppression of a large state. And that sounds very nice and lofty on the surface. But when you start analyzing it more closely, you start seeing that there's a certain artificial nature to the whole thing. So to do that, to see the artificial nature of that protection of the minority or the small state, let's consider an abstract example. Let's say that you have a group of 22 people in front of you. And you decide for some reason to divide them into five groups. So you look at the 22, and then you see that eight of them are kind of like next to each other, and you say, you eight will form one group, and we'll call you Group A. And they might look at each other and say, why us? Well, you just were standing next to each other, so I'm picking you as one group, a group of eight, and we'll call you Group A. And then you see two of the people standing next to each other, and then you say, okay, you two are going to be another group. You're going to be Group B. So it's Group B with two, Group A with eight. And the two will look at each other and say, why us two? Well, you were next to each other, and you just look good together as a group. So you're Group B. And then you keep looking, and you see half a dozen people standing next to each other again, and you say, okay, you six are going to be the third group. You're going to be Group C. And then you only have six people left, and out of those six, you decide to split them into a group of four that you will call Group D, and a group of two, the last two remaining, that will be Group E. So now you have five groups, A with 8, B with 2, C with 6, D with 4, and E with 2. Okay, so now you artificially divided this group of 22 into a group of five people with diverging numbers in each group. So now you say that you say to each group, each one of you groups will decide which one of you within the group will represent you, and he will vote on behalf of all of you. So then the group of eight will have one representative with one vote. The group of two, group B, will have the same one representative, and so on with all the groups. So now you have five groups and one vote each. So let's say that now you offer a suggestion to them, and you ask them to vote on it, and based on the system that you have established, let's say that for some reason the three smallest groups, which would be group B with 2, group E with 2, and group D with 4, let's say that they decide that they like the suggestion, so they will that their representatives will vote for that suggestion, and then the other two groups, group A with 8 and group C with 6, don't like the idea, and you know their representative talks to the rest of the group, and the group in general more or less says no, we don't like the idea, so their two representatives vote against the suggestion. So now you have the suggestion winning 3-2 because the three smallest states voted for it. Well, not states, but groups of people, but obviously we're conceptualizing them as states. And the other two, the three small groups voted for it, and the two large groups, the largest groups, voted against it, and the suggestion passes. But if you think about it, the three groups that voted for it, the three people who voted for the suggestion, represent a total of 8 people, because it's 2 from B, 4 from D, and 2 from E. 2 plus 4 plus 2 is 8. So 8 people, in a sense, on average, you could say voted for it, and the two groups that voted against it have a total population of 14. So a suggestion that was more or less favorable to 8 people and that was more or less unfavorable to 14 people has just passed. And why are we setting up a system where these three small groups can override the will of the other two groups? So you see an example there where you have artificially created a separation of the people in such a way that you can have very small minorities in certain circumstances overriding the will of the entire majority. Let's say that the suggestion was to buy a pizza with anchovies. And maybe the three small groups liked anchovies, and the other two larger groups didn't like it, didn't like anchovies, but now they're stuck. They'll have to eat the anchovies because the eight wanted it. And you set up a system where the eight were able to override the taste of the other 14. And then, so you can see an example where there's a certain kind of arbitrary irrationality to making that division of people that way and giving them voting power that way. But now let's think about another fact that any of the two groups that had two people in our example, group B or group E, let's take group B. That group has the same voting power as group A, which had 8. That means that each person in group E has 4 times the voting power, the 4 times the influence on any vote as the people in group A. think about it. Like, Group A has four times as many people as Group B, but Group B has the same voting power as Group A. Therefore, every person that was assigned to Group B has four times as much influence on any decision as any person in Group A. And the question is, why? What was so special about the people in Group B that now you're giving them so much more power than the people in other groups? And when you think about it, if you divided the group randomly, it was just a product of happenstance that those two in Group B were standing next to each other by themselves, and you decided to group them into just one tiny group. And the other eight guys were just standing there, and you just happened to group them. And just because of happenstance, these A people are underrepresented and have far less authority on anything that happens to them than the other people in smaller groups. Why? That doesn't make any sense. It's very very artificial, very irrational. And that's why, if I'm not mistaken, it was Hamilton who at one point mentioned or wrote, it might have been in one of the Federalist Papers, but at some point Hamilton, if I'm not mistaken, wrote that he considered the states to be more or less artificial entities. Because why is Virginia where it is, and why does it have the size that it has and the boundaries it has? It was just a product of historical circumstance. The same with Maryland. Lord Baltimore, you know, came from Britain and decided to establish a colony called Maryland, and it just happened to have these boundaries, and that's how it was born. The same with New York and Pennsylvania and so on. So all of these states are just a product of happenstance. And why would a person who is born into a state, a large state, be by default given less authority on decision making than a person that's born in a very small state? Why do the people of Rhode Island have so much more power than the people in Texas, in the Senate? Why? What is so special about the people of Rhode Island? Are they born, are they children of a better God than the people in Texas? There is, so as you can see, there's something very artificial about this. And you say, okay, well, the idea was to protect the little states from the tyranny of the large states. And I could be wrong on who said this exactly, but I believe it was Madison. It must have been either Madison or Hamilton, but I would say it was Madison who wrote at some point that he considered that the chances of a large state oppressing a small state were very minimal. That dynamic of these states that hated each other and wanted to take advantage of each other, that dynamic never existed in the colonies. And if you consider the history of the U.S., can you really think of an example where one big state was trying to bully a tiny state in some matter? And the answer is really no. There really is no historical precedent for any of that. And even if that had been happening, is this scheme the right solution? And as you can see, it's so artificial that it really doesn't seem to be the right way to go. So if your concern is about protecting a minority, why do you want to protect a minority only if it's in the form of a state? If it's a tiny state, then you protect it through the Senate. If your concern is about protecting the little people from the small groups from the tyranny of the large groups, well, can't we start making an argument then that we should start creating voting groups based on like oppressed minorities? Let's say black people could have one vote, and a certain other racial group another vote. And all these other these minorities that have, you know, had some history of oppression or whatever, to protect them using this scheme, we should just create these groups and give them the same voting power so that the majority will be people who are born into the majority race will be forced to accept that they have less power of voting influence than a minority. So why a state? Why if we have this concept of protecting minorities by placing them into these artificial groups, let's create artificial groups for racial minorities then. So you can see how the whole argument starts degrading very quickly. And to be frank, if you really want to protect a minority, you should start focusing on the most important minority, because if to you a minority is always some sort of group, then the question is, what type of grouping do you use? Do you use race, ethnicity, statehood? What do you use? So to overcome that artificial constraint, you have to start thinking about what is the smallest minority that you can think of? What is the smallest minority in America? And some people might say, oh, it might be the albino Eskimos in Alaska. That must be the smallest minority. No, that's not the, let's not think in groups. The smallest minority in America is the minority of one, the minority of the individual. That's the smallest minority. That's the minority we have to protect. In other words, if we have a country of 300 million plus one, let's say that's the population, 300 million Americans plus one, then if one American, one individual American, is being oppressed by the other 300 million fellow Americans, his or her rights are being violated, that one single individual should have the power through the Constitution to easily defend himself against the 300 million Americans surrounding him. One person against the rest of the country should be able to successfully defend himself or herself under a well-written constitution. That's the minority we have to think about, not about these artificial state divisions that we have created. So that's the first problem, how the Senate tackles the concept of minority. And also, there's another important thing when you think about minorities. If you have, for example, a majority of 15, that and a minority of 5, let's say, in a group of 20, and let's say that the issue at hand is, should we sacrifice children to some deity? Should we just start grabbing babies and killing them and plucking out their hearts and throwing it down some temple steps? So that we can have a better harvest. And let's say that 15 of the people say, no, I don't think that's such a great idea. Maybe we shouldn't be killing babies like that. And the other 5 say, no, we need a good harvest, and we're not sure if these deities exist, but it's better to be safe than sorry. So let's go ahead and do the baby sacrifices. Would you think that if the 5 feel that they have a constitutional right to kill babies, and the other 15 say, no, that's not such a good idea. If you have a situation where the rights, so-called, to kill babies of the 5 is suppressed by the common sense of the other 15, do you think tyranny happened there or not? So you have an example there where the majority, let's say under some sort of system, is able to override the intents of that minority of 5. Is that by definition tyranny? Obviously not. Tyranny only happens if the right of an individual is being violated. In this case, the rights of little babies to have a life is being violated. Therefore, the tyranny would happen if the minority is allowed to win. So when you start, that's one game Democrats play all the time, that it's always minorities versus majorities, and everything gets viewed from that perspective. If there's a minority and there's a majority, then the majority is the oppressor, the minority is the oppressed. And if the majority wins, there's tyranny. If the minority wins, then there is victory. But it's not like that. It doesn't matter if it's one against a million or a million against one. The question at the end of the day is who is violating the rights of the individual, and whatever number is violating the rights of the individual, that's the one that has to be defeated somehow. And the rights who are the people who are defending those rights have to be allowed to flourish. So whenever people start defending the Senate by appealing to some sort of minority defense in one way, shape, or another, then you have to remind them that that's really not the point, and that this concern that people had about small states being oppressed by large states never really happened. Let's think about a second problem that that comes from the Senate, and it has to do with the concept of democracy versus a republic. And this is one thing that conservatives always like to point out, and point out with a lot of pride for some reason, that they always say, well, America is not a democracy, it's a republic. And they always say it, you know, they always say democracy with disdain, because it's in the context of the mob mentality, the majority just bullying the minority, and that the founding fathers were so brilliant that they set up this system where that mob mentality cannot really, you know, get any traction, and it's because we don't live in a society where the people directly decide on everything. When a bill is passed, it's not that 200 million Americans voted for it and 100 million Americans voted against it. It's that the representatives that were sent or voted in by the people voted for it or against it. So it's a group of 400 people in the House of Representatives, 400 plus, and the 100 senators who are voting on behalf of the people. And that's what constitutes a republic, where you don't have direct democracy. It's a democracy through delegation, and that barrier of separation is what prevents us from descending into French Revolution madness. And conservatives always say this with a lot of pride. And yes, it makes sense to do this layering of because it would be impractical. For the 300 million Americans to be voting each time on every issue, and imagine a debate involving 300 million people. I mean, nothing would ever get done. So from a practical perspective, yeah, it makes sense to have a republic. In other words, a system where you are delegating, the people are authorizing representatives to vote on their behalf for a certain period of time. But the problem is that the Senate takes that concept one level further, because at least when it started, the Senate wasn't elected by the people, it was elected by the state legislatures. So that meant that the people would vote for the people they wanted in their state legislature, and then those people voted for the people who would end up in the Senate. There's a certain concept of elitism, like a further separation from the unwashed masses, and a lot of people from the founding fathers era found that very appealing, because they had a distrust of the masses, and they thought that the second layer of a Senate that has this further one extra degree of separation from the people was a safe thing. So you see that it was born with a certain problem. And yes, in the 17th Amendment, that was changed in the sense that now people vote senators directly into office, and it's not through the state legislature. But still, the concept of these two chosen ones from, and it's only two. So there, still the concept of elitism remains there. These two who represent the entire state, And if it's a small state, then they have more power per capita than the two who are sent from a very large state. So the Senate, in a sense, is a perversion of the republic concept. It's adding extra layers of separation from the people, because the fact that there are two senators from each state means that it's not because it's not two senators because that state had a certain number, certain population. It's regardless, even if everybody in Rhode Island died out, it was just one little guy. That one little guy still had get two senators in the Senate representing him. So yes, the people are voting the senators in, but it's still there's a conceptual separation. So once you've decided who wins the state, and it's two people, regardless of how many people voted for those two. So I hope I'm making sense. So you can see that the Senate is the republic concept taken to a greater, to a more elitist level. And whenever you have something that's conceptually wrong, so we've seen the problems with the Senate. Whenever you have something conceptually wrong, fundamentally wrong, even if it's not clear and overt, with the passing of time, that fundamental flaw will eventually be manifested. And as some of you may have anticipated, the problem that surfaces, or the greatest problem that the Senate has, in practical terms, has been the filibuster. And as some of you may know, the filibuster is the idea that people can go on the floor and debate a bill before it gets voted on. So they espouse the good points or the bad points of the bill. And after hearing all the debate, then people are supposed to vote. Well, in the Senate, you have the situation where if you can talk, debate constantly on the bill, and use that as a mechanism to prevent the bill ever being voted on. And that's the concept of a filibuster. And so, well, how did that get started? At the beginning, there was no filibuster. It's not that idea of filibustering is not in the Constitution. It was not written into the Constitution. And one of the big mistakes that the founding fathers made was to tell each house, you can make up your own rules. Like, for example, in Article 1, Section 5, it says, each house may determine the rules of its proceedings, punish its members for disorderly behavior, and with the concurrence of two-thirds, expel a member. So both the House and the Senate were given a blank check by the Founding Fathers to make up the rules of procedural rules however they wish to make them up. So instead of them thinking about how to create at least a framework that would prevent corruption or unwanted political results, they just said, "Okay, you guys decide how to run things." So at the beginning, neither the House nor the Senate had any concept of a filibuster, but they had both houses had the same rules. And there was a rule that they both had called the previous question motion. So the idea was that if there was debate and the debate was going on, they could have a vote to say, do you want to enter the debate? And all that was needed was a majority vote. So if the majority said, oh, enough talk, let's vote, then all talk had to end and they could vote on the issue. And for some reason, in 1806, then Vice President Aaron Burr, at that time, if I'm not mistaken, Jefferson was the president, Aaron Burr argued that the previous question motion was redundant. And the fact that it was the vice president is relevant because, as you know, the vice president has in the Constitution, is strongly connected to the Senate. He's a tiebreaker in any 50-50 vote. So the vice president being so connected to the Senate, started saying to the people in the Senate, hey, this previous question motion is redundant. Even though it had only been used once in the previous 4 years to when he made that remark, I'm still not clear on what he meant by the rule being redundant. And I guess what he was trying to say was that, well, if a bill is has approval, majority approval, it looks like it's going to pass, let's say, then if you ask people, do you want to end the debate, the people who are for it will want to end the debate, and the people who are against it will want the debate to continue. So if more or less you could say that generally the votes to end the debate will be the same votes that the bill will get when it's actually voted on. And I think that's what he meant by the vote being redundant. So he said, let's get rid of that that rule. And the brilliant people of the time said, oh, yeah, let's get rid of the rule. And when they did that, so they modified the rules of the Senate. And it's so sad. No one figured out that now we are left with a situation where there's no way to end the debate. Because the only way to end it, the previous question motion had been removed because it was, quote, redundant. So the geniuses of that time, and many of them were founding fathers who were there still alive at the time, didn't realize that they had just opened this Pandora's box. And you could say, well, the filibuster option was really not used much. At the beginning, in the first few years of the 19th century. And it's so ironic that the filibuster, which could have been used by the northern states to start opposing slavery, was never used for that. Never. Every time the northern states in the Senate would just compromise with the southern states. And that's how we got the Missouri Compromise of 1820, for example. That compromise where Missouri was accepted as a slave state, but any future states that were above a certain, I think it was the southern border of Missouri, more or less the southern parallel of Missouri, those states would have to be free states, at least the states in the Louisiana Purchase, if I'm not mistaken. And you would say, well, there was this weapon that they could have used that was given to them foolishly by Aaron Burr, and they could have tried to utilize it, but they never did. And they preferred compromise over such a unholy issue than to fight it. And it's because, as we were saying, if something is born with something bad, that bad thing will eventually manifest itself. The Senate was born out of compromise, so it's natural that whatever would come out of it later on would be full of compromise. So that's why the filibuster was never used. But then we got to 1917, so we got to the 20th century, and Woodrow Wilson wanted to arm some American merchant vessels against German U-boats because the Germans were doing a lot of attacking. So he wanted to arm American vessels, and there were 12 senators who decided to say, no, we don't want to arm our vessels against German U-boats. I have no idea why they didn't want to do that. So they said, oh, there's the filibuster rule or non-rule, and they decided to filibuster, and they were able to kill the bill. So 12 senators through filibustering killed the bill. And when Woodrow Wilson saw that, he said, hey, we have to do something here. So the Senate then decided to create what's called the cloture rule, where if two-thirds of the senators present and at the time of voting decided to kill the debate, they could kill it. So finally, there was a rule to end debate again, but it was by two-thirds of votes of the people present during voting. It was not the simple majority that was present in the original previous question rule. But even with the cloture rule, killing filibusters was still very difficult because 11 cloture attempts that were done between 1927 and 1962, they all failed. The minority kept filibustering and killing bills that were unpopular in their states. And that's how Democrat senators, Southern Democrat senators, were able to block civil rights legislation. So you can see that the elitism that the Senate was born from would manifest itself once again in promoting the elitism of Southern whites over black people. So so we got to 1970, and in 1970 there was the introduction of a two-track procedure that lessened the power of the filibuster a bit, because part of the problem with the filibuster was that you could only vote on one bill at a time. So if the current bill is being filibustered, the Senate could not possibly do anything else. They had to, you know, end the filibuster or, you know, withdraw the bill. And if they couldn't withdraw the bill or end the filibuster, the Senate was powerless. So in 1970, they said, okay, now we can have two bills at the same time. So you can have one bill that's being filibustered while another bill is going through the process. And unfortunately, when that happened, that had the effect of telling the senators, now you can filibuster to your heart's content, because you're not going to be suffer a political penalty if you filibuster and be condemned for having paralyzed legislation. So that's when filibustering really took off. And in 1975, Democrats had a 61 senator majority in the Senate, obviously, and there was one independent that was caucusing with them, so they had 62 votes, you could say. And so the Democrats, who are always changing rules to fit their agenda, changed the rules so that you didn't need two-thirds to kill a filibuster, you only needed three-fifths. And why three-fifths? Because they had three-fifths at, you know, 62 votes at that time. So so they lowered the level of how many people were needed to end the filibuster. But as a compromise, they agreed that it had to be three-fifths of all senators. So not just three-fifths of the senators who decided to show up that day to do their job. It had to be 60 out of 100. So if only 50 show up, it wasn't 60% of the 50 who show up, it had to be 60% of every senator around. And even with the lower percentage, filibustering has just become a very successful tactic to paralyze legislature in the Senate. And it's interesting that all this time, the House never went into filibustering mode. And why? Because the House was born out of different concepts. And so metaphysically, conceptually, the House of Representatives is not prone to accepting filibustering the way the Senate is, because the Senate is full of compromise and full of elitism. And in elitism, if you think about it, it's always a privileged minority oppressing a non-privileged majority. That's elitism. A nobility that has a lot of power, a group of a few who want to protect themselves from the unwashed masses. So that's why in the Senate, the idea that a minority can stop the work of the majority is more natural than in the House of Representatives. I hope this is making sense. Alexander Hamilton at one point said that the supermajority concept in the Articles of Confederation was one of its main evils, because this thing that basically you need a supermajority to actually pass anything in the Senate. If you don't have 60% support, it's very difficult to get anything done in the Senate, because even if you have 54, 53% support, let's say, for a bill, Then the other 47% is just going to filibuster away until they kill the bill. So the only way to truly pass the bill is if you have a supermajority supporting it. And this concept of a supermajority was also prevalent in the Articles of Confederation. And Alexander Hamilton criticized it. He said it was one of its greater evils. And he said it doesn't bring security to our nation. It embarrasses the administration and destroys the energy of government. And that's exactly what the Senate does all the time. And just, I know this audio clip has gone much longer than most, but I saw a Wikipedia article on the U.S. Congress, and it's very biased, as you can imagine, very pro-Democrat, pro-liberal. But one thing that caught my attention is that they had this chart of, you know, who has controlled what house over the years, this graph, you could say. And down below the graph, it has a caption that says, since 1980 or something like that, the Democrats have won five elections. But they have only been able to freely legislate in 2 years out of those five presidential victories because of the filibuster in the Senate. And then as a side note, they said, oh, the Republicans also have had similar issues, similar problems. And it's ironic that it's interesting that they emphasize that, oh, we, the Democrats, have not been able to do anything because of the filibuster. Oh, yeah, and by the way, the Republicans have had the same problem. But regardless of the bias of the statement, you can see that, yes, it's a very obvious and clear fact to everyone that the Senate is a place of stagnation where bills go to die. And the problem is when you have a supermajority that is stifling legislation, then legislation that requires political courage never really survives. Only the cheap stuff, only the easy stuff that is demagogic, that is candy or sweets to the masses, that legislation passes without a problem. But the legislation that requires a sacrifice, that requires courage, that requires long-term commitment will never pass when there's a supermajority system. And some might say, oh, well, the supermajority has protected us from bad things. Well, really, think about it. We have I've lost count of how many trillion of dollars we have in our national debt. Do you really think that the supermajority in the Senate and the filibuster concept has saved us, has really stopped the government, you know, doing stupid things? Look at all the disaster that's going on. Has the filibuster rule really done anything to stop all this nonsense? No. The thing is, we shouldn't have these artificial internal conflicts in the government. It's like we have over glorified the concept of checks and balances, and this is seen, the filibuster seen as some sort of check and balance. But yes, I believe in checks and balances, but you can take the concept too far. I would rather have the people in Congress do what they need to do or they want to do for 4 years. Let them go crazy. Do whatever they want. And instead of having this conflict, and if they're going to destroy the country, let them destroy the country. They're already doing it anyway. But let them go ahead and do it. You know, if you're going to go run over the cliff, let's just go full throttle and just race towards the cliff and go over. Why am I saying that? Because the problem with this tension that we have, where no one really gets anything done, and then the bad people sneak in a few bad things and they mess up the country. When the country realizes the bad thing that happened, what do they do? What do the bad people do? They point to the good people and say, oh, it's their fault. They are not letting us do our work, and we should be doing more. But this wouldn't have happened if these people had not blocked us. But if the Congress and the president, whatever, are doing whatever they want, and they are driving us over the cliff, they will have no one to point to and blame. It will be very clear. It's, if we follow this direction, we go to disaster. If we follow this direction, we'll prosper. So there will be no ambiguity as to why we're in the state we're in. If we're in a good state and we see that these people have been doing whatever they want for 4 years and it's worked, then we go, okay, let's give them 4 more years. But if they drive the country to hell, and we see it, obviously, and they have no one to blame but themselves, they have no one to point to, then it will be easier to then kick the bums out and vote in new people. But to have this tension all the time where no one gets anything done, that there's stagnation and paralysis, only allows them to point at the other guys when things go wrong. And that's what happened in 2008. And I don't know if this is a topic for this audio clip, but the housing crisis was the product of Democrat legislation. But because there were enough Republicans present in government at the time, they were able to demagogically blame it on the Republicans, and the Republicans were too stupid to know how to counter argue, and people got duped into voting for Democrats in 2008, and then we had the beginning of the big decline of the country that we have going on even today. So I hope that through all of this, you have a better sense of why the Senate is such a terrible idea. It was born out of elitism, out of compromise, and it has really done nothing but cause problems. The only reason why there was a need for a Senate was to protect slavery. There is no other reason, really, if you look historically, to assign equal voting power to each state. The only justification for the Senate was to keep slavery. And we know all how that went. We ended up with the Civil War and 600,000, or I forget the exact number, of Americans being killed. So I would dare argue that the Senate is a bad idea. And just as a final note, someone kindly pointed out to us that the concept of federalism was probably borrowed from the Amerindian tribes in America, because the Amerindian tribes had more or less that concept. They had these groups of tribal groups that were autonomous, and they had like a more central government, but they were loosely tied to it, and that the founding fathers saw this model and kind of tried to emulate it in our Constitution. And so basically what you have in federalism is tribalism. You have these groups that have their own, you know, little interests, protecting their own little interests, separated and isolated from each other. And that's what federalism breeds, this tribalism. The states wanted to, when the states wanted to preserve their sovereignty, in the face of federal power, it's because the politicians in each state government wanted to continue being powerful. The governor of Rhode Island wanted to continue being powerful. He wanted to feel as powerful as the governor of New York or the governor of Virginia. So that's why the states wanted to maintain equal voting power in the Senate. The states were protecting their interests, and they wanted to protect, to prevent other states from encroaching on their special interests. And that's what elitism does. It starts promoting the protection of special interests of select minority groups. And that's what you have in the Senate. And that's why we have to get rid of it. It is destructive. And we have to get into a system that allows for the freer flow of legislation, and then we can hold people accountable. Because if you let them do their thing, it's like having a football coach, like an American football coach, that you let him run the team. Just let him run the team. Don't get involved. Don't mess with him. Let him run the team for one season or two, and look at the results. If he's a disaster, then you kick him out. If he's successful, then you keep him. But if you're interfering with him, like owners do many times, constantly interfering with the coach, and the team fails, well, then there's no way of knowing. Did it fail because of your interference or because the coach is just bad? Just let him run the show. Give him freedom. Select him wisely. Give him freedom to do his thing. And if he's a bump, kick him out. If he's, Vince Lombardi reincarnated, then keep him. And we, with a Senate and a bicameral system, the way it's set up, and where states, people from some states have twice or four times as much power as people from other states, we should, with a system like that, we're not going to allow for a proper legislative flow and to do the things that require courage to get this country out of the impending disaster it's in. So I'm sorry that this audio clip ran so long, but hopefully we have covered more or less the basic concepts regarding the Senate, and we'll be talking about federalism in future audio clips. Thank you very much.